Central Time, Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly program on religion, ethics, and spirituality. Steve Shoemaker is unable to be with us this afternoon. He's out of town, and I am replacing him. My name is Don Nolan. I am a professor emeritus of philosophy and religious studies at Parkland. And we are very pleased today to have a guest with us named Professor Larry Greenfield. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Professor Greenfield is going to talk with us about his activities with the Protestants for the Common Good Journal and related activities up at Chicago. Professor Greenfield is currently at the University of Chicago Divinity School. He graduated from there. He is also the editor and theologian in residence for the journal Protestants for the Common Good, and the co-founder of an organization called Religious Institute on Sexual Morality, Justice, and Healing. And I take it you're also still a visiting lecturer at the University of Chicago Divinity School?
From time to time.
Is that right? Well, we are here to talk about one of your activities of your group and something that I believe that you're deeply concerned with, and that is the issue of abortion rights in general and related issues. But before we get to this topic from the perspective of your religious tradition, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to this particular topic?
Well, I had the good fortune of going to college and graduate school in the 1960s. And as a person who had grown up in a family that was deeply committed to the church, the 60s had a way of making me think about the relationship of my faith to the social order, to the political order. And, of course, as you'll remember, a lot of things were happening at that time mm-hmm. in terms of racial justice, in terms of women's freedom, the nature of war and peace. And I, being in Chicago, I did my graduate study in Chicago. I couldn't help but drink of that water deeply, and I think that kind of set my career trying to think about how my belief in a sovereign God of grace committed me, demanded of me not only my personal commitments in terms of my personal life and my family life, but also demanded something of me as a citizen of this country. So that's really how it got started. Uh-huh. And I'm very grateful that just by the luck of birth, I had a chance to think about this issue and have it shape the way I live and think ever uh-huh. since.
Just for the information of listeners, this is a call-in program, and if you would like to ask questions of Professor Greenfield or the topics that we're discussing, we encourage you to do so. The number is 333-9455, or you can also call 1-800-222-9455. The local number again is 333-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit more about how the 60s shaped you. Obviously, Roe versus Wade in 1973, changed the political landscape of the country. Many people say that that Supreme Court decision was the most important one of the, at least the last half of the 20th century. Can you talk a little bit about where you see that decision today? Do you anticipate it being changed, overthrown, and what are the implications of that from your perspective?
Would it be all right if I went a little before
Certainly.
Roe v. Wade? Because
Please.
It has to do with why I'm so concerned about it. When I was still in graduate school and moving into positions of ministry, This was prior to Roe v. Wade. And I don't know exactly how it happened, but I got related to some clergy people who were concerned about issues of abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the public policy issue, but just the pain and suffering that women were experiencing in their lives in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I got associated with that group of people, we wanted to do something. And so I found myself, prior to Roe v. Wade, driving women, picking up women in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. Taking them to a suburb where there was a clinic waiting for them while they had an abortion, and then driving them home. And as someone trained in ministry, I had to talk with these people, and I learned firsthand of the importance of moving toward a policy in which this was not illegal, where women's health was at stake,
mm-hmm.
That really got me then involved not only in transportation of women who needed abortion, but to really start working on public policy issues. And it was a heady time. Clergy at that time, remember, were very much involved in this.
This is
pre-1973. We were really pushing for abortion rights, mm-hmm. At that point, and it was a cause of great rejoicing. And if you'll recall, after Roe, there were a large number of denominations and congregations,
mm-hmm.
who went on record in support of this decision that said, yes, there is something fundamentally at issue in terms of justice here, as well as health, that we need to support, because already at that time there were people who were resisting. Now, you asked, Don, what's happened since? And I think there's a way in which we've all too often taken Roe for granted and have missed or have forgotten the situation pre-Roe,
mm-hmm.
that I experienced with these women. And certainly their suffering was tremendous. I think it's the case that the clergy have forgotten it. I think there's some degree in which younger people who have never had that experience.
You might want to describe what the conditions were that so concerned you before 73 for women in Chicago.
Well, I mean, a woman who wanted an abortion either had to find a clergy or a organization like ours that was really working to find doctors, nurses, mm-hmm. who would provide safe abortions, or it was a matter of going alleys. Garages, and young women were losing their lives. I mean, permanently damaging themselves. And the simple fact of the matter is that
because the access was so restricted.
You simply didn't. You couldn't do it in a hospital. You couldn't do it in a doctor's office. Or if you had money, the wealthy could do this.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the middle class could not do it, and certainly the poor,
mm-hmm.
Could not do it. So that today, with a program like Title X, a federal program that provides reproductive health services, it really is an issue not just of health, but it's an issue of equality in terms of economics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a huge number of women today who need abortions for reasons of health, well-being, get that reproductive health service through Title X. And this current administration is intent on limiting and diminishing the funds that are available, mm-hmm. For that service. And what I see, to get back to your question,
this brings us back to 73.
Back to the question that we're going back, I fear, slowly, incrementally back.
And what does that mean, do you think?
Well, I think it means some things in terms of the health of all women. It certainly means something about our commitment to women as moral agents. It's to say the government is going to control your decisions about your reproduction. It's interfering in women's lives. The most important decision, probably a woman, one of the most important decisions a woman can make. We're saying, woman, no, that's not your decision to make. This is a decision for the government to make. So we're a little bit like, on the one side, Romania, mm-hmm. under Ceausescu, mm-hmm. Where you had to have 5 kids or you were penalized. You got 10% of your salary taken away if you weren't exercising your fertility mm-hmm. in some way. Abortion was illegal. This was an ideology operating. Or China. Again, another very different but a coercive government. What we're faced with is a government in this country who again wants to tell women how they should live their lives and is denying them their basic humanity as ethical, mm-hmm. moral creatures.
We do have a couple of callers, but before we get to that, let me just give you an opportunity to get one more thing on the table here before we start our conversation on air. You have, along with the Religious Institute on Sexual Morality, Justice and Healing, have produced what you call an open letter to religious leaders on abortion as a moral decision. Just very, very briefly, can you describe how they came about?
Yeah,
We'll take the next call here, if you just be patient.
This was an organization I helped found in around 2000 that we were concerned, this religious institute, that increasingly sexuality was not seen as a God-given gift that should be used responsible, mm-hmm. but was seen negatively in almost every respect. That is, every dimension of culture, religions including, were treating sexuality as something negative, mm-hmm. something to fear. When if you look at the scriptures of our great traditions, sexuality is something to be celebrated. To be sure, it was to be something we used in a disciplined way, but it was something of a divine gift, mm-hmm. To be used responsibly. At that time, around the turn of the millennium, the century, we produced a document, a declaration on this subject, trying to give voice, a religious voice, to the responsible use of sexuality. And I think at the core of that was to see sexuality not, or ethics, sexual ethics, not as as defined by particular acts, mm-hmm. but in terms of the kind of total witness of scriptures and the religious traditions,
right.
Which in terms of my tradition and Judaism, largely in terms of Islam as well, it is a God of love and justice.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller who's patiently waiting here, so we'll take our first call here. Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was listening to Dr. Greenfield, and I was just wondering if he's had any interaction with Dr. Bernard Nathanson or Carol Everett at all.
I haven't. Tell me a little bit more.
Dr. Bernard Nathanson was the lead proponent for Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court hearing in 1973,
uh-huh.
and he was the leading abortionist at that time, and he has since gone on record as saying the number of women that were damaged through back-alley abortion clinics he personally perjured and lied on the stand, and he's now stopped doing abortions because he advocates there's more harm done to women through the abortion experience than there is to go ahead and have them carry to term. And then Carol Everett was one who was an abortion clinic owner in Dallas who's kind of come out and said the same thing. The longer they were in it, the more they saw they were harming women instead of helping them. Are you familiar with any of that discussion at all?
Yeah, sure. I'm familiar with the discussion, and I think it has to be honored. We need frank, open, truthful discussion. Abortion is a terribly important moral decision. It's also a health decision, and I would want to argue that it's a religious decision. And I don't have any problem with religious individuals or citizens generally or religious communities saying we oppose abortion. My problem comes when that position becomes the normative public policy decision of the nation, so that people who take a different position than the two individuals you mentioned, as honorably as I believe they are, giving testimony to, there's something fundamentally wrong with privileging that position to the exclusion of the number of physicians, healthcare workers, women throughout the country who believe that this is not just a moral decision, but one that affects their lives, their physical health lives. So understand my position is not to deny people their right or tradition's right to counsel against abortion. My position is basically not to impose that position on everyone else.
Why don't we talk a little bit, or first before we go on, just for the sake of those of you who would like to have the number repeated, if you'd like to call in to talk to Professor Greenfield, the number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Why don't we go a little further into this? You, in your open letter to religious leaders on abortion as a moral decision, have a passage speaking about respect for life, and you affirm that value, that commitment. To someone who is concerned that pro-abortion position or pro-choice, the words can be explosive either way, relates to how you feel about the status of the fetus.
Yeah. Oh, this is one of the reasons why we developed this statement is that Roe took place in 1973. Here we are, what, 32 years later, and a lot has happened. A lot of water has passed under the bridge since that time. So that those of us who were central in developing this statement thought, you know, we ought to take a look at everything that's been, as much as we could, everything that's happened, the arguments against choice and so on, and explore them again. One of the most important thing I think that we had to face was the increasing recognition that fetal life has value. Mm-hmm. Now, as a matter of fact, in the Roe decision, there is some recognition here. Those justices, 7-2 decision, said that the state has an increasing interest in fetal life the more it develops, so that a woman had great freedom to choose an abortion in the first trimester. But by the third trimester, the justices were arguing that there really is a state's interest here. Now, I think that also has tracked and become even more widespread in terms of its judgment. In terms of science, that there is greater sensation.
Capacity for suffering.
Capacity for suffering. So that even now, when we have all of this fetal surgery, there is anesthetic at certain points and when earlier it isn't. So one of the crucial things we had to face was, has the discussion so advanced that we would change our understanding of a woman's right to choose based on what we now know about fetal life? And I think the conclusion we came to was that indeed we have to recognize that there is value, increasing value in fetal life, and therefore with Roe v. Wade, that the reasons really have to be compelling in the later stages, that there is some interest, some justification for states' interest in this. But then in the end, Roe was basically correct that if you're going to have a notion of women as equal and as women as decision makers, then that has to take precedence over, especially when the issue is the woman's own health, the woman's life, the woman's future, that has to take precedence mm-hmm. in terms of public policy right, that the woman has to retain that right to choice.
Might be helpful if I just very briefly read a passage from it. It reads, "Our religious traditions affirm that life is sacred. Our faiths celebrate the divinely bestowed blessings of generating life and assuring that life can be sustained and nurtured. Religious traditions have different beliefs on the value of fetal life, often according to greater value as fetal development progresses. Science, medicine, law, and philosophy contribute to this understanding. However, we uphold the teaching of many religious traditions. The health and life of the woman must take precedence over the life of the fetus."
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, and in the next paragraph, we really try to say, if you're really concerned about reducing abortions, then you will be even have heightened concern and support for sexuality education, for family planning and contraception, and for prenatal care. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're really committed to this notion of reducing abortions, what's so darn frustrating is so many times the people who oppose abortion rights are the people who want to deny contraceptive services, family planning, who have a very restrictive view of sexuality education, who want to limit that only to abstinence education, when most of the evidence shows that if you provide kids and adolescents the kind of education they need, comprehensive education, you're going to have decreases in the number of abortion. That's what we experienced in the 90s, all the way up to 2003. Now we've had a reversal of policy. The Bush administration has spent almost $1 billion supporting abstinence-only education as opposed to comprehensive sexuality education. Now, let me add here, comprehensive sexuality education includes abstinence. But already in the last couple of years, in a number of states, we've seen the number of abortions rise.
And I think I've seen somewhere, perhaps you can confirm this, abstinence education only has had some counterproductive results.
Some, although I think everybody agrees that we need a lot more research on the consequences of both types of education. One major study of abstinence education said, indeed, teenagers will delay sexual activity based on a commitment made as part of an abstinence-only education. That commitment will last about 18 months, mm-hmm. And then they will be sexually active. The trouble is, of course, is that when they become sexually active again, they have no information about how to engage in healthy sexuality. So they are more prone to sexually transmitted diseases, to unintended pregnancies, and all of that. It's frustrating to see that if you really do respect life, that you would be supportive of this sexuality education and family planning.
Our number once again is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Why don't we talk a little bit about language here and the political climate that you are now struggling with. President Bush speaks of attempting to nurture what he refers to as a culture of life. The flip side of that, by implication, is that you and your activity is associated with a culture of death. How do we get over, if at all, that level of discourse?
Well, it does seem to me that part of it is to recognize that there's more than simply scientific information that's at stake. There are really conflicting ideologies operating here, probably on both sides. And you know, one of the reasons why we wanted to put out this statement is to encourage frank, candid dialogue between the opposing parties. But it isn't simply the issue, the rhetoric of life. I mean, the truth, you know, the president's gag order, which was one of the first things he reversed when he came in 2001. 46 million women across the globe have unintended pregnancies. And of those, 46 million have unintended pregnancies for which they want abortions, mm-hmm. and will have abortions. Half of those, almost half of those, will be done where it's illegal or whether it's unsafe. Mm-hmm. Now tell me, if you're concerned about life, about the life of those women, thousands and thousands of deaths, because we are denying, because this administration has said, we will not provide any reproductive health services if the
foreign aid,
if the even if the word abortion is used. Now, you know, the trouble here is that that's a right that women have in this country, but we refuse to honor that right to other peoples, mm-hmm. other women of other nations. I mean, I think the other part of it, quite honestly, is you get all this rhetoric about freedom and liberty, the inaugural address, spreading freedom, spreading liberty. Mm-hmm. I think that's really terrific. But then in the next breath say, we're going to try and eliminate choice for women as moral agents. Mm-hmm. Now, as a matter of fact, if you eliminate choice, then you've eliminated the possibility of a woman being moral, of making an ethical decision. So we're using the rhetoric of life and of choice, and then instituting policies which are simply opposite to it, that mm-hmm. undermine that choice for half the population in this mm-hmm. country and significantly more throughout the world.
Just to point out, in your closing of your open statement, you do say, we call for increased dialogue and respectful listening with those who disagree with us. And with them, we share a vision of a world where all children are loved and wanted, and to renew the call for relational and reproductive justice for all. Have you had success along those lines?
To some degree.
And getting this level of respectful dialogue?
Not a lot. Not a lot. I think it's a situation where those of us in the choice community, and it isn't a monolithic community. A woman named Frances Kissling, who is head of an organization called Catholics for a Free Choice, has really taken some steps to open the dialogue within the Catholic Church on this. Hillary Clinton, in her recent speech, I think it was in Buffalo in late January, took some steps, I think, in that speech. I've looked at it, and I think she's taken some steps to try and foster the dialogue. I have the sense many times that the people on the opposite side really don't want to talk about it. Their minds are made up. Although, you know, I was a part of an experiment underwritten by the Pew Charitable Trust, where we actually got half of the group in the meeting that were anti-choice, and half of us were pro-choice. And I think we did. As a matter of fact, the fact of us sitting down together and working on it, I don't know that anybody's minds was actually changed, but at least we kept in conversation, not mm-hmm. only during the meeting, afterwards.
Didn't start throwing chairs.
No. And there have been experiments in various locales on the common ground movement that I think has helped. Mm-hmm. I think the fruitful discussion will probably not be on abortion itself, but it will be on issues like sexuality education, family planning services, issues of contraception. I mean, the vast majority of the American public is strongly supportive of family planning.
I was startled to see you list some remarkable figures here. You say more than half, 53% of U.S. Catholics identify themselves as pro-choice, and more than 6 in 10 61% believe abortion should be legal.
And that's been fairly consistent for a couple of decades now. That is, even within the Catholic community, there has been strong support. And, of course, I mean, the Crowleys in Chicago that did that major study for the Vatican had recommended that the Vatican change its policies. Mm. And the Pope at that time didn't accept the recommendation. So there was even a stronger voice within official Catholicism in support of opposing family planning and contraception. Now, I mean, let me just try one more thing here. I think everybody, a large number of the population, agrees with President Clinton, former President Clinton, and the earlier George Bush before he got in the Reagan administration. He was a strong supporter of family planning. And then had to give that up when he became vice president under Ronald Reagan. But I think that there is large popular support for the position of abortion being safe, legal, and rare. Mm-hmm. I think the issue, one of the major issues we've got today is a fourth issue, and that's accessibility. We've got vast portions of the country where there are no clinics, mm-hmm. where you could abortion is safe and legal and rare, but it's rare because there aren't clinics for it.
I read somewhere there's only one left in Mississippi, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, and Mississippi has taken some very negative stances within the state. I mean, the other places where this whole accessibility issue has some relevance is in poor people. Mm-hmm. If we are successful, if the Bush administration is successful in reducing funds for Title X or of changing that, we've got an issue of real economic inequality mm-hmm. For poor women who will simply not be able to afford.
As always, the rich or will be able to get abortions.
Yeah, and even if by some chance the president were able to appoint a Supreme Court that would overturn Roe, I don't think that's terribly likely, but it's possible.
I was just getting ready to ask you, what do you think the likelihood is?
I think there's strong precedent for Roe. Mm-hmm. I think, the swing votes here. There aren't a lot of swing votes. If Rehnquist resigns or dies, it won't change the courts. If John Paul Stevens were to retire, that would be mm-hmm. important. Sandra Day O'Connor, another swing vote, has been very important in retaining Roe. Over the years, that could change.
Where's Kennedy? Justice Kennedy.
Oppose. Mm-hmm. Oppose. He's the other swing vote. But Stevens, I had a conversation with Stevens year and a half ago, and he didn't give any sense to me. He told me in the conversation, he says, I'll tell you, Greenfield, when I'm going to resign. And I thought, gee, you really want to do that? What he said was, I enjoy writing my own opinions, and when I don't enjoy writing my own opinions, that's when I'm going to resign. So I got no information about any plans he has. I think the chances of O'Connor and Rehnquist resigning or retiring is more likely, and in that case, I think it'll be a tight decision, but I think there will be retention. I own my own sense, and maybe I'm just being overly optimistic here.
Even with two new appointments from Bush?
Yeah, because it doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Only one would really change the count.
We have a caller here. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Line 4? Line 4?
Yes, line 4.
I didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
First of all, my understanding is that abortion was illegal way back when, way back centuries ago. The other thing is, you said the Catholic Church, you know, bringing the emphasis of the Catholic Church. I don't think it's just the Catholic Church, though, is it? I mean, the Islamic religion, many Protestant religions. What else do we have there?
Oh, you're right.
Wait, I'm not quite finished.
Yeah.
You also mentioned these three words, need, health, and well-being of the person. I'd like to elaborate on that, and I do have a problem with the government coming in on moral issues, getting involved with religion and moral issues. I think they should be out of the picture, the government, in any way, shape, or form, of not only that, about everything. They keep going into our lives with moral issues, and I protest that. I'm a religious, I follow Catholic, Roman Catholic Church. And also, I don't think you're telling the other side of the story, though, about abortion. The depression, et cetera, of many people who have abortions, it haunts them. Plus, they have horrid abortions, after effects after the abortion. And when they say pro-choice, they really mean pro-death. So I am mainly pro-life. And also, when their abortions, they got into a lot of rackets, businesses, we call them, with selling the organs, et cetera. It's all money-making propositions, just like the embryonic stem cells they want to push. Stem cells I'm for, but not embryonic stem cells.
What?
It's all a racket, money-making racket. So please respond to that.
That's, I was going to say, that's a lot on your plate.
You've, and I may not remember all, so jump in when I forget. I certainly agree with you that this is not simply a Catholic, a Roman Catholic concern. Number of traditions in the Protestant community. Although, as a matter of fact, most of the mainline Protestant traditions are on record in support of abortion rights, and even though it's been contentious debates in annual or biannual meetings, for the most part, mainline Protestant traditions have continued to support abortion rights. Now,
these are national statements.
National statements,
like American Baptist Church, Christian Disciples of Christ, Episcopal Church of America, Presbyterian Church, and so on.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that these are just blanket statements. Each mm-hmm. one has a nuance, mm-hmm. Carefully crafted to reflect their distinct take, their theological and ethical take on the issue. But when it comes down to it, they say this is a right that has to be respected. Now, it's a little different issue when you deal with the Protestant right, that is the more evangelical, conservative, fundamentalist groups. And they are not only – they show a slight rise in terms of the number of people. Actually, as a matter of fact, the breakdown of Catholic, Jew, Protestant, various kinds remains fairly stable over time. I think what you do see is
you're talking about demographics, populations in those
populations in those groups. I think you do see a more vital role on the part, or a more vocal and vital role on the part of the Christian right, at least. And one of their banner issues is anti-choice. And there's no denying that. So when you point to the fact that this isn't just a Roman Catholic, that's a very helpful correction, and I want to. Just as in Catholicism, there is not uniformity among the religious right on this. There are people, principled people on the right, who recognize that this is a issue. This is primarily libertarian, the libertarian portion of the right. who recognize that there has to be the retention of this right if you're going to have equality of rights between men and women.
Just to clarify, by libertarian, you mean those in the right who are passionate about separation of church and state.
That's right, and who take a basically more broadly an economic position, mm-hmm. Free enterprise. This is the Milton Friedman's right. Of the world.
It is remarkable, isn't it, to the extent to which libertarianism, as far as the church-state separation, has collapsed. It seems it's pretty clear that that division with respect to abortion has dissipated.
Not very vocal.
Right.
Not very vocal. Now, the second issue that the caller brought up was the commercialization or the rackets. I think this is a huge problem.
It did happen.
It has happened. I don't think it's a huge problem, but it's a problem that we always have to work on, this commercialization of life. I think my own judgment is that this has this commercialization of life has really denigrated virtually all of the religious traditions that are true religion in America. Is free enterprise economics. That's what we really believe in. And so it's not surprising that someone's going to try and make a buck one way or another off this, and we just have to fight it, expose it, and fight it when it happens.
Mm-hmm. Just because, just because someone misinterprets what a movement or set of principles means, it doesn't follow that's what they mean.
That's right.
There are always people who misinterpret. Why don't we move on a little bit and talk about the organization Protestants for the Common Good. How did this get formed and what role does it play in advocacy for abortion rights?
Well, it takes a little different role than the one that we've been talking about in terms of the
Religious Institute for Sexual Morality, Justice, and Healing.
That's mm-hmm. right. This is an organization that I helped bring into being in the mid-90s. And it was on this issue that we've just been talking about, that is that the divisions in religious America are no longer primarily about denominations, one denomination over mm-hmm. against another. As a matter of fact, there's been amazing success in the ecumenical movement, where theologically many of these traditions agree. Now, there'll be some differences, but for the most part, there's been strong consensus. The major divisions within religious America now is between the right, and the mainline mm-hmm. and progressive. And
even within mainline organizations?
Even within mainline organizations. Mm-hmm. That is, the fights that go on are not between Baptists and Lutherans so mm-hmm. much anymore as they are within the Baptist community, right. within the Lutheran community, within the Episcopal community, within the Presbyterian.
Thus we get split after split.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right. Now, and the strange thing is that these mainline and progressive traditions were once the ones who were most vital and vocal in taking public stands. And it was the conservative fundamentalist groups that mm-hmm. said, we don't want anything to do, nothing mm-hmm. to do with public life, with politics. Stay away. It's corrupt. It's degenerate. That's changed in the last two, three decades. It most remarkably, it's changed in terms of the Southern Baptist Convention, where you had movements up till about the beginning of the 1970s that were really very progressive in terms of Southern Baptist life.
Just in case readers or listeners don't know, it's the largest Protestant denomination in the country.
Right, mm-hmm. right. It got taken over by people on the right. Well, my point here is that you get this strange reversal where the right that historically has wanted not to be involved in politics now is the most vocal in terms of trying to get religion into politics and having, as the caller mentioned, having the government take moral and religious stands mm-hmm. virtually. Mm-hmm. Whereas that tradition that historically was most influential in terms of public policy, has pulled back. Protestants for the Common Good came into being in the 1990s, mid-1990s, to say the religious right does not speak for all of religion, in this, particularly Protestant Christianity, that there is a very strong tradition here that says a central part of your faith as a Protestant Christian is to be active in public life. And to be that the affirmation of a God of love commits you, if you believe that, to work for justice, not only to be involved in charity and compassionate works, but also to develop public policies that advance justice. Now, your question, Don, was how does that relate to the abortion rights issue? For us in Protestants for the Common Good, it really is an issue about the 14th Amendment. That is, we believe that religiously, democracy is at its best is the form of government that most approximates our central affirmation. That is, because God loves us, we are to love God in return. And how do we love God in return? We love all whom God loves. If there, therefore, is great inequality in the society, we ought to be working for ways in which that equality, inequality is overcome. One of the ways in which there is great inequality is this movement where you would take away the rights of women to make moral choices about their health and well-being.
Let's come back to that just a minute. We have a caller on line one. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Good evening. Yeah, I am very glad to hear this discussion. I'm one of those kind of strange progressive liberals. As a personal value, going back to my my youth, I have always been opposed to abortion, but I do believe it's not my place to make choices for other people, which I know is a position that probably drives people crazy. But I've noticed that it's become very doctrinaire. I'm a child of the early 70s, and part of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War protest was a very strong religious presence of people who were following a belief that this was, you know, justice and that life was to be valued. And I think there's been almost a doctrinal approach to belief recently, which I find very strange, in that there's a doctrine that abortion is wrong, but if 100,000 Iraqi civilians are killed in either a just or an unjust war, that's not my choice to make, there's no hue and cry over 100,000 deaths. And for me, as someone who's a very actively involved in the social justice movement as a social worker, a helping professional, what I find ironic is that people want to protect the rights of unborn children, which I believe is commendable, but they don't care about the kids after they're born, and they don't care about them after they grow up. And if they live in poverty or in a really horrible neighborhood, everybody says, well, that's just in that neighborhood. And, you know, they kind of shut it out. So I wonder if you're feeling about the difference between doctrine and belief. I mean, I know that's probably going back to the roots of, you know, Christianity, but I'm just curious if you feel there it is a doctrinal issue, or if just the definition of belief has changed. And I'll listen. Thank you.
Well, as a theologian, I'm always interested in the way in which religious claims are backed up theologically, that is, with rationales, and the traditional way in which that's done is through doctrine. Now, as a Protestant theologian, I'm always part of what's going on there is you're always reforming your theological statements, and the point is that doctrines can never become a kind of idol. They can never become unquestioned norms. They've always got to be rethought through. And I think you're right. There's a way in which that dimension of theology has lost its currency. And theology has become kind of the enunciation of inherited doctrine. And it comes very convenient then if you're already...
As though it's been fixed for all time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good point. I was interested the other day that I read something by Bill Moyers, where he equated theology, by which he was talking about the religious right, theology, and ideology. Well, as a theologian, I took some exception to that, even though I agreed with his general point. Mm-hmm. But theology needs a revitalization, and insofar as it is rethinking, you know, as Karl Barth, this famous theologian from the beginning of the 20th century, said, you know, theology is having that Bible in one hand and the New York Times in the other hand, and seeing where they come together, and that means that the more we learn about Scripture, I think we're learning some things about Scripture in terms of women, the role of women or of gay people, and so on. So we're learning new things about the Bible, and we're also learning things about developments in society, mm-hmm. which really requires us to be more theological.
That's interesting. Do you see theology revitalizing on the progressive side of the scale?
Yeah, I do. I do. I
are
think
things
there's...
going on at the University of Chicago and other places now?
Yeah. There are people in your field, Don, and ethics and theological ethics, comparative ethics. Mm-hmm. You are a person who deals with world religions, comparative religions. I find a lot of activity going on in terms of trying to people trying to think about, you know, here we are in this interconnected world. How do we begin to think theologically between these major traditions? So it isn't kind of how do I do Baptist theology? It's how do I do theology in a world that's very interconnected?
Well, since 9/11, there's been an upsurge in interfaith dialogue, and obviously you've been involved in that since the 1960s. I'm just curious if there's some sea change in that kind of activity that is in the progressive movement that is being brought to bear, and does Protestants for the Common Good represent anything like that?
Yeah, and it's strange. It's happening in a couple of ways, Don. One way is on the theological side itself, where there is more discussion, it seems to me, about the implications of religious faith, belief, doctrine to troubling public issues. That, I think, is taking place. I don't think the press is predisposed to covering that, and so it doesn't always get wide circulation, but it is happening. Now, the other part where it's interesting to see is where doctrine isn't so important, and that is to say that there is some beginning conversation between the more evangelical, not the fundamentalist, but the conservative and evangelical communities within these traditions and the mainline and liberal traditions about saying, you know, we're probably not going to agree all that much in the end on where we are doctrinally. But our commitment to certain things that are in our scriptures causes us to get together even with our theological differences. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in our organization, we had something that started prior to the election and now continues called Let Justice Roll.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Bringing together evangelical, mainline, and progressive Christians in this instance to say, look, we may disagree about certain doctrines of Christ or the church or the end times, whatever, all these established systematic theological doctrines. We may disagree on that, but it's fairly clear in terms of our scriptures that Jesus says you better be concerned about the poor.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't so much, you know, what you believe, but what you do here. And if you believe in a God of grace, then you will care for those who are marginalized, those who are in need, those who are poor.
Before we take our next caller, do you want to give the website for people who might be interested in this activity?
Yeah, the website for Protestants for the Common Good is www.thecommongood.org, all one word.
Very good.
And we do a bi weekly magazine, electronic magazine, which is always which is available on the website. I edit that. Always have a column, and we try and we do a lot of things in terms of legislation that's occurring in Illinois. What's happening in Springfield?
I wanted to ask you about that. We have a caller on line one. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. You have a question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This isn't actually a question so much as a comment. I just wanted to address the misconception that pro-lifers are necessarily religious or right-wing. There are a lot of us who are progressive and liberal and very secular, and we're not opposed to the rights of women as much as we are in favor of the rights of unborn children. And
thank you very much for that call.
That's a helpful point. I don't mean to reduce it all to the religious community, although I think that's where the press often gives gives voice to it.
Well, you have been involved down in Springfield, I believe. Recent non-discrimination bill just passed the Illinois Senate and House. I think it was on January 10th. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Want to describe that a little bit?
Well, for a long time, people have been involved in trying to establish equality for people on the basis of sexual orientation. And time after time, even though the House of Representatives in Springfield would pass this human rights amendment that would basically provide equal rights for gays and lesbians in terms of work and housing, employment, the more conservative Senate always either refused to take it up or defeated it. It looked for the life of me, I couldn't see how we were going to pass it this time. I'm a board member of the state's ACLU and talked to some people there, and they weren't all that optimistic about it. I have to say I was as happy as I've ever been.
65 votes.
It isn't to make a statement about whether you're for or against gays. It's saying, you know, just as American citizens committed to democracy, committed to equality, to justice, to deny someone opportunity to work, for housing, for all of these things on the basis of orientation is just unjust, un-American, undemocratic.
Well, we're just about out of time here. Very, very grateful that you joined us, Professor Larry Greenfield. He is involved with the Protestants for the Common Good. Primarily based in Chicago, isn't that right?
Well, we're
statewide.
We're all throughout the state,
right?
And we're doing some things nationally now as well.
Right. And you're very active down in Springfield, and I take it also across the country. You do some national work as well?
That's right. That's right. We're especially concerned about issues of housing and on welfare reform.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
This is Don Nolan sitting in for Steve Shoemaker. This is Keeping the Faith. Join us again next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Radio has the power to make a difference in your life. Public radio has a responsibility to make a positive difference. You can help us make that difference with your pledge of support at 217-244-9455 or online at will.uiuc.edu. And thank you.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASC-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, light rain likely this evening, then occasional light rain after midnight. The low in the lower 40s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, occasional light rain with the high in the upper 40s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a chance of light rain in the evening, then a slight chance of rain after midnight. The low in the lower 30s with west winds around 5 miles per hour in the evening, shifting to the north 5 to 10 miles per hour after midnight. This is WILL Urbana. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.